Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the thrice weekly Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on May 29th of 2011 under the headline The Real Story of the Corvallis Naked Ladies Cult, How It Began. Here we go. In the years after one-time Corvallis resident F. Edmund Creffield died, his legend got weirder and weirder. But then it was pretty weird to start with, and it was not the kind of story that mellows with age. By 1951, 45 years later, it reached something of a high watermark in a story/article in Startling Detective magazine headlined Nemesis of the Nudist High Priest. Pulp fans will instantly recognize the startling part of Startling Detective as the telltale hallmark of a pulp magazine. And indeed, for the true fan of the wild and shameless sensational, this article does not disappoint. The article paints a fantastic picture of a lascivious con artist posing as a holy man, sharking up a flock of the town's comelier ladies and preying upon their weak feminine minds with a diabolical message. Clothing is vanity. Let's all get naked and roll on the floor. It gets worse. The article goes on to relate how the prophet Creffield, calling himself the new Joshua, convinced the lucky ladies that one of them was going to be the new Mary, mother of the next Jesus, and that he would be standing in for the good Lord and making the necessary carnal arrangements so that would happen. So, this thoroughly untrustworthy account continues, Creffield started a selection process in which the brainwashed beauties were, if you will, auditioned. Naked, of course, behind closed doors, in a process that sometimes involved whips. No, really. The whips were a nifty addition to a yarn that was first set to paper by legendary Oregon writer Stuart Holbrook in 1941. Holbrook, delightful though he is to read, simply can't be trusted on stories that touch on religion. And if I were compelled to defend that statement in court, his version of this story would be Exhibit A. In it, he's remarkably snarky and eager to believe and pass on the most lascivious and scandalous of the many rumors that flowed out of this case. Holbrook's article was clearly the primary source for the Startling Detective story. The real story of Creffield's cult, which came to be known as the Bride of Christ Church, is quite a bit more believable and more nuanced. It certainly relies a lot less on the once prominent myth that women are naturally gullible, stupid, and, absent the steadying hand of a man, easily led into promiscuity and sin. In other words, if you're female, you'll find the real story a lot less insulting. But the real story is, if anything, even more disturbing than the augmented ones, because it lacks the comforting feel of stereotype and fantasy. It's a story of good-hearted, well-meaning people who, in the name of goodness and holiness, opened the door to evil and chaos. The story, if you will, of how the saintly can become the tools of Satan. The story starts in 1903, when Creffield, a 30-ish native of Germany burning with religious fervor, left the Salvation Army because he thought they weren't holy enough. I will now pause for a moment so that those of you who are familiar with the history of the Salvation Army can pick your jaws back up off the floor. Yes, not holy enough. Creffield settled in Corvallis and started preaching, building a flock of super strict believers. His followers were like the most hardcore Pentecostalists you can imagine. At the same time, their extreme simplicity made the plain-dressing Quakers look like French royal courtiers by comparison. They prayed face down on the floor, occasionally rolling over in a sort of power grovel, hence the pejorative term holy roller, which may have actually started with this very group. Their church services were loud, sincere, and disruptive to the neighbors, full of wailing and gnashing of teeth and lasting for hours on end. They drag on into the night until the small hours of the morning. Well, Corvallis residents got along reasonably well at first with their new, freakishly hyper-holy neighbors, but things started going sour within just a few months. The main reason was Creffield taught that believers were to have nothing to do with unbelievers. That meant that if a man or woman joined the group, he or she was to cut off contact with any family members who had not also joined. wives, husbands, children, parents, whatever. Well, here's how that played out in Corvallis. A married couple would join the church. After a while, the man would get tired of the extreme self-denial and subjugation to the will of Creffield and drift off. His wife would then, at some point, identify him as a non-believer and cut him off. If there were children involved, they would either stay in the church and be cut off from their father or leave the church and be abandoned by their mother. It was not a healthy dynamic, no matter how it played out. Soon Creffield had a reputation for breaking up homes and a flock consisting largely of women, women who actively avoided their infidel family members. It also bothered the rest of the community that Creffield's cult members were living in a communal house, men and women together. Moreover, their simple clothing consisted of a plain cloth wrapper, which apparently looked a lot like a bathrobe. The outsiders felt it was inadequate to protect female modesty, and in any case, it looked entirely too easy to take off. By itself, this communal living arrangement would have been bad enough. But Creffield's followers combined it with a mania for secrecy that all but invited other community members to fear the worst. Members vanished from their families' lives into a locked house with barred windows supervised only by the cult leader and his cronies. And things got worse. Following yet another pattern that would become all too familiar to the world in later decades, think David Koresh and Jim Jones, the lack of contact with the outside world and the unstinting adoration of his flock started doing things to the mind of the cult's leader. His message got increasingly unbiblical as he claimed he was receiving instructions directly from God himself. He promoted himself from the second Joshua to the second Elijah, which, if you know your Old Testament, is rather a big step up. Finally, the men of Corvallis organized a little party for Creffield. They marched him and his sidekick, Brooks, to the edge of town, stripped them naked, painted them with pine tar, covered them with feathers, and ordered them to get out of town and stay out. Creffield responded by appearing the very next day at the courthouse in Linn County, his skin bright red from scrubbing and reeking of the turpentine used to remove the tar, and marrying one of his followers, Maud, a daughter of the Hurt family of highly respected Corvallis pioneers. A few months later came the pivotal incident in our story. The incident that would doom Creffield and much of his flock. A man named Burgess Starr filed charges against Creffield for adultery, accusing Creffield of sleeping with his wife, Donna. Creffield promptly went into hiding. Weeks later, he was found naked and filthy, hiding in a coffin-sized hole under a follower's home in Corvallis. Hauled into court, he unhesitatingly admitted guilt. It had been part of a vital, God-ordered purification ritual, he explained. This development electrified Corvallis. All over the area, people started making the same connections. They thought about all these women refusing to speak to their husbands and fathers, praying and rolling around in somebody's house or on the sect's encampment on a secluded island in the Willamette River under the supervision of an avowed adulterer who saw nothing wrong with having sex with somebody else's wife. Could it be Donna Starr wasn't the only one? Perhaps God was ordering Creffield to purify other women, too. Really, given the evidence, it would be hard to think otherwise. It was probably at this time that the rumors got started about Creffield's alleged plan to impregnate a selected follower on behalf of God Almighty. It's possible that this rumor was true, but I found no solid evidence to back it up, and neither have Phillips and Gartner, who spent a lot more time looking than I did, Phillips and Gartner being the authors of the book Murdering Holiness, published in 2003. This is also, almost certainly, the point at which cult members' ostracized family members started thinking seriously about assassination as a solution to the Creffield problem. We'll talk about how that worked out in part 2 of this report, which will be uploaded next week. Key sources in this story have included works by Jim Phillips and Rosemary Gardner, Stuart Holbrook and Brian Booth, and Lewis Thompson. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do. Visuals that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you will also find full citations to the sources for this story. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Got an idea for a show I should do or just want to say hi? drop me a line at fj@offbeatoregon.com or ping me on Twitter @offbeatoregon or send a message through the Facebook page at facebook.com/oregon.1859. Also, do let me know if you're ever going to be in Corvallis with time for a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and an inclination to talk about Oregon history. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way around 6 a.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. So if you're looking forward to the next one, well, you haven't got long to wait. Until then, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.